I do notice some new faces. Welcome to you all. I'm Martha Tremblay. I work with the Los Angeles County Sanitation Districts, and I have the pleasure to be the chair of the commission. So with that, because we are short one person, we'll start off as a workshop. As soon as we reach quorum, then, you know, in terms of we can address any of the action items that we need to address. So with that, maybe we can start and Caitlin can do her instructions.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So we're grateful to have Delray Yacht Club host us and have audiovisual support from AGP staff. If you're new to the space, restrooms are to the left down the hall, just past the exit signs, and help yourself to water in the back of the room. If you need Wi-Fi, we have it written on the table by the front doors. It's DRYC underscore clubhouse. Password is capital P Palawan 1108. This meeting is in a hybrid format in which members and the public are participating both remotely and in person. For members and the public participating remotely, if you need technical support connecting to or using the Zoom platform, please email it@agpvideo.com. Now I will provide some information on how public participation is organized for today's meeting. You must be in the room or on Zoom to make public comment. Members of the public may request to comment in the following ways. If you're in person, please fill out a speaker card located at the table in the front of the room and give it to myself or Luke. And if you're joining via Zoom, you can raise your hand virtually when we reach the item under which you'd like to speak. The raise hand function is at the bottom of the screen on the Zoom app. If you're calling in over the phone, dial *9 to raise your hand and *6 to unmute yourself. This meeting is being recorded and live streamed, so we ask that you please speak clearly. And please remember to turn on your microphone when you speak and turn it off when you finish speaking. That concludes the overview of logistics. I recommend we move to member roll call for attendance.
Yes, thank you, Caitlin.
I will call members in alphabetical order by last name. Please feel free to also state your affiliation when I reach you. Give me one moment to share the roster. And if we could have the what I'm screen sharing shown on the TV, please. I'll go ahead and start. Sabrina Ashtian.
Present.
Marcella Benavides.
Here, representing LA County Public Works, Director Pastrella.
Cody Bridges.
Here.
EJ Caldwell.
Here, representing West Basin Municipal Water District, alternative to Director Gloria Gray.
Okay, sorry, I think the feedback was me. Jacob Berman.
Oh, still going on. We good. Jacob Berman, alternate to Vice Chair and Councilwoman Tracy Park.
Okay. Laura Doss Hertz.
Here, Vice President of the Bay Foundation Board.
John Erickson.
Here.
Can you use your mic?
John Erickson, City of West Hollywood, West Side Cities COG. Here.
Thank
and if you.
You
don't get quorum and I drove from West Hollywood to be in Delray today, we're going to see some fireworks.
Tom Ford.
Tom Ford, Director, Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program.
Tracy Laverick.
Here for the Santa Monica, sorry, Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains.
Annalisa Moe. Joining us remotely.
Yes, hello. I am here. Emily Parker is hopefully going to be my representative today.
Karen Mogus.
Here, representing the State Water Board.
Dan Murphy.
Here, representing County Los Angeles Fire Department Lifeguard Division.
Zane Obagi.
Here, representing the South Bay Cities Councils of Governments
As the alternate to Dean Francois, and I'm a council member of Redondo Beach.
Warren Ontiveros.
Present here representing County of Los Angeles, Department of Beaches and Harbors. I'm alternate for Director Gary Jones.
Tracy Park.
Here, Councilwoman, 11th District, Pacific Palisades to Playa del Rey.
Emily Parker.
Here representing Gila Bay and sitting in for Annalisa Moe.
Michael Quill.
Marine Programs Director at LA Waterkeeper, and I am here.
Greg Rishal.
Present, President, Black Surfers Collective.
Martha Tremblay.
Present, Martha Tremblay, LA County Sanitation District.
Laura Wardrip, sorry, Laurel.
Morning.
Erica Yelensky.
Good morning, Erica Yelensky with U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Region 9, and it's nice to see all of you in person. And just quickly, my manager is here today, Sona. She's sitting, so please say hi to her. She manages our watersheds office. Thank you.
I believe that's all members. Did I miss anyone in person or virtually? Okay, that'll conclude roll call. I recommend we move to item 1 for public comment.
Great. Thank you, Caitlin. So item 1 is comments from members of the public on items not on the agenda. And I believe we have one public commenter.
Yes, we received one request in advance from Walter Lamb to comment under item 1. Walter, would you like to come up? And don't forget to unmute the mic. Just give us 1 second to share your timer. Oh, we have the timer. If you could show the, we're screen sharing it. Okay, thank you. You have the floor, Walter.
Earlier this year, last year, probably into January of this year, if you went to visit the website of the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program, you'd see a very prominent link saying climate change. And if you clicked on that link, you'd go to a page that said climate change affecting Santa Monica Bay. Climate change places stress upon the 7 key habitats. It goes into talk about the connection with greenhouse gases. And then below it says the disruptive changes. This is the old website. Disruptive changes driven by climate change include, it lists a number of disruptions, including a chemical change in ocean water that makes it more acidic. Parentheses, this is caused by absorption of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And then further down, there's a learn more section, because part of your mission is to educate the public. And under Learn More, there were 4 tabs. Vulnerability assessment, that's for your climate vulnerability assessment. Protecting and restoring, monitoring ocean acidification, and related links. After the Trump administration came into power for the second time, that webpage got deleted, and a new webpage called Climate Resilience replaced it. The Climate Resilience website struck out the part that said driven by climate change. It struck out every reference to climate change. It deleted the connection between ocean acidification and carbon dioxide. Right, this is Project 2025. This is what the Trump administration wants. When you did this, you were not victims of the Trump administration's assault on the environment. You were enablers. You enabled this because you did what the administration wants, which is for scientists to stop using basic, well-established scientific terms. I think a bigger problem is that as this was going on, as you had your vote and as the executive committee spoke about this March 20th, your National Estuary Program director and the EPA representative had written guidance that was amended on March 17th by the Trump administration that expressly acknowledges ocean acidification. Now, they didn't do that because they care about ocean acidification. They did that, and you're seeing a lot of headlines about lawsuits. They're saying, contrary to what Board Member Ostjohn said, there are laws that govern, right? And it's interesting because the law, the grant is called the Section 320 Clean Water Act grant. So, Board Member Ostjohn, it is subject to laws. I was at a protest on Monday, people holding lots of different signs. Nobody was holding a sign saying the federal administration can do what they want, which is something that you said at the April 17th meeting. That's dangerous. It's false, and it's dangerous, and we're seeing that danger right now on our streets. So I'm going to ask you not to just keep sliding this under the rug. Board Member Berman, you said it was absurd to delete ocean acidification. Board Member Valencia specifically asked this question, and when it was being answered, the EPA grant manager had guidance, written guidance, that said not only should you, it said you're instructed to stay on top of ocean acidification. That was the term they used. They didn't change it to changes in ocean chemistry. I'm asking you not to slide this under the rug. This is important. And look, we've got some other issues that we're going to raise, right? Talking about the catch and kill non-disclosure agreements. We're going to get to the bottom of that. Better if you just, if you're just open about it for NEP staff. We have a big problem right now with this commission as to what happened at April 17th. You right now today could vote to restore that language to this website. It's a website. It's not the grant application. It's a website. If you don't today, look at your NEP director, ask why you weren't given a copy of the written guidance that instructed you to stay on top of it.
Thank you, Walter. That is your 4 minutes.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for public comments. Didn't want to deprive Luke of his favorite part of the meeting. So next item is 2A, order of the agenda. Do we have any revisions, any suggestions, or we're okay with the order as is? Okay. All right. Next item is a report from the chair. I just want to share with you on May 15, the executive committee met. We received updates from commission staff on their work. We discussed the development of the update to the Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, the CCMP, and the State of the Bay report. And then we established, which actually Luke will give a little bit more information in terms of some of that discussion. And then we also established the agenda for this meeting. And that's it for my report. Any questions? All right. Next item is 2C, report from the Technical Advisory Committee. Luke?
Thank you, Chair. The chair of the Technical Advisory Committee and the vice chair could not be here today, so I will give the report. On April 28th, a Technical Advisory Committee meeting was held at Loyola Marymount University. TAC Chair Dr. Dan Pondella provided a presentation on Occidental College's Prop 50 project, surveying nearshore rocky reef habitats. And Dr. Rochelle Tanner provided a presentation on the latest research on communicating science to the public, which we discussed with the executive committee meeting at the executive committee meeting last month. The TAC also, during that meeting, discussed ways to improve the draft State of the Bay report, which is a comprehensive assessment of ecological health of Santa Monica Bay. And chapters of that report will begin getting published late this year or the beginning of 2026. That's it for the TAC report.
All right. Thank you, Luke. Any questions?
Chair, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Luke, are these TAC meetings open to the governing board members?
Yes. However, we just ask any governing board members, just let staff know before you plan on attending. But these are meetings open to members as well as the public.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions to Luke on this item? All right, next item is the report from the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission Administrative Director. That's Luke. And then next will be Tom Ford, the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program Director. So who's going to go first? Luke?
Yeah, I could take it if that's fine. So in April, the Governing Board passed Resolution 2502 to provide support for LA County's Coastal Resilience Initiative. Staff forwarded that resolution along with a letter from the chair to LA County Board of Supervisors. So that's something we did since the last meeting. Also since the last meeting, commission staff worked with the Bay Foundation to complete the semi-annual report for the National Estuary Program that was submitted to the EPA on April 30th. So thank you to those who submitted updates for that report. That is it for my update.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Martha. Am I coming through okay for everybody? Martha, at the end of the last meeting, you called me. You're like, how about some pictures? I brought some. All right. Going to see if we can make this happen. Caitlin has even armed me with a device. All right. Beautiful. That's us. We're here today. All righty. I'm trying. Not sure where to shoot it. All right. Here's a shot overhead of us in our lab in San Pedro working with some abalone. In that case, those are red abalone that we're trying to motivate to spawn so that the eggs and sperm would be released into the water. At that point in time, we try to maintain the right balance between the number of sperm and number of eggs that are there. And for the next 7 days or so, those abalone larvae, which you can almost see like day two, are spinning around in a water column, and then they settle out to the bottom of our tank where we start feeding them an entirely different diet. So they start off, again, nearly microscopic. That's what an adult red abalone shell looks like. Pass that on down. I've got a few other species for you as well. Here's some green abalone. This one's a pink. Right, thank you, Laura. This one is a black abalone. In that case, like you're like, oh, that makes sense. The other names are like go get it. I could explain that to you, but I don't want to take up all of our day. A big part of the target of this effort is the recovery of this snail from extinction. Still sits on the species in the spotlight at National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration of one of the 10 species most likely to go into extinction. So we work with a broad partnership with folks in Baja all the way up into Alaska with lots of complementary work across universities, commercial abalone farms and the such, figure out how to try to save these animals. And we put a bunch of them out on the reef this year. I even brought some numbers so that I get that right. So 1,650 individual white abalone were placed out in the ocean. And our next slide will get us to what that looks like. No worries. So the abalone, when they are about an inch in length, get placed in these pods, protective outplant devices. And they're in there for maybe 2 weeks. We stuff a bunch of kelp in there. That's their preferred food. And then we'll pop open the ends of those pods so that they can egress out onto the reef at their pleasure. And then we spend time thereafter chasing them down, trying to find them as they hide deep in the cracks of the rocks. So this work with red abalone, white abalone, principally, we have outplant sites in Palos Verdes. We are outplanting abalone to Point Loma down in San Diego County. We're now working on the mainland coast in Santa Barbara, and we have plans for outplanting abalone to Catalina Island this coming year. All in all, that's a synopsis of some of the abalone work that we've been doing. Could we get to the next slide, please? You don't get to keep those, Sona, just so you know. Okay. Next slide, please, Caitlin. No worries. Oh, no, it's already up. That was my bad. Oh, those both work. So neighboring our rocky reefs, which make up the minority of our nearshore habitat, the rocks are about 14% of the bottom of Santa Monica Bay, is the large expanses of sand and soft bottom habitat, which is available habitat for eelgrass. So this is an actual vascular plant that grows up out of the sand when conditions are right. It serves as a nursery habitat and a beautiful biodiverse, next slide gets to the point, habitat that we're working on trying to figure out how to restore. We've had some very successful test runs off of Catalina Island.
A bunch of what we have to figure out are the proper oceanographic conditions as they exist off of our coast so that the grass would persist, that there's enough light, that there's the right temperature, that there is the right pH, that there's sufficient amounts of dissolved oxygen to make this all work. And although I'm here in a suit most of the time and in my office more than that, every now and then the old guy gets to go out into the ocean and count some stuff. So that's just a shot of reminding me to tell you about our monitoring and the actual work that we're doing underwater to make these things materialize. All right. Certainly our coastal systems, be that our tide pools, be that our deep water canyons, and everything in between, really do have a very close tie to kelp, and the health of our kelp off of our coast pushes nutrients and calories into all of these systems, provides habitat. I don't wish to ignore our kelp work. I'll have some more stats for you later this year on our efforts there. But all in all, to date, with eelgrass, abalone, and kelp, we've made 68 trips out there onto the ocean this year. That's Malibu, Palos Verdes, Santa Monica, Santa Barbara, Catalina, La Jolla, Point Loma. I sound like Johnny Cash here, but that's where we've been up to. Next slide, please. Hello, Harbor Seal. All right. Make sure everybody gets a shot there. Okay, cool. Next slide, please. All right. Along the beaches, and our efforts in this case have with many partners all along throughout all these operations, quite notably LA County Beaches and Harbors in this case, state parks, City of Malibu, City of Santa Monica, City of Manhattan Beach, City of LA. We know that we can get these native dune plants reestablished on our coastline. When they grow, they block the wind with their branches and leaves. The sand stops blowing, piles up, starts to bury the plant. The plant goes, I don't want to be buried, and grows again. And this dynamic continues, and the sand starts to pile up. And we can keep ahead of sea level rise. We can reduce coastal flooding and erosion with these approaches. And we've done this with a tremendous amount of volunteer support this year. So the next few slides give you an idea what this looks like. So that's Manhattan Beach, and we're doing some photo surveys of the plants. Here's a representative of the volunteer effort, in addition to what the staff have been doing to get this back. And you're looking at lovely assortment of beach evening primrose in that picture. Next slide. Here we were working on a plover enclosure that existed on... that existed on Santa Monica Beach and has now been made part of a larger project footprint. That's just the team digging out some old metal stakes that we would rather not use in the future. Next slide, please. Here we are planting some California poppies into the beach of a variant that can tolerate that saltwater environment. Next slide, please. And in Manhattan Beach, if you were to go down there today, you would have the opportunity to see hundreds of endangered El Segundo blue butterflies flying about. The males are very active in the afternoon when it warms up. The females kind of stick to the flowers. They exist as adults for only a few weeks at a time, and that's the end of their life. But we are seeing the recovery of this species expanding back into areas of its natural habitat. Next slide, please. Yay, flowers. Next slide. All right. On to our efforts, in addition to so many of you in the room, to improve water quality and reduce loading of pollutants to our coastal waters. We work with the State Clean Boating Network and have a program that takes boaters, folks like we would imagine bumping into here in the marina. They take training, they become dock walkers, they become advocates promulgating best management practices for their fellow boaters. So we've got about a core of 100 of these folks that work the docks and talk to their friends. And we also distribute clean boating kits that have some of the key elements that you need to clean up your pollutants and manage your gas spills. We've distributed just over 2,500 of those this year. And our team was out inspecting. Next slide, please. The over 65 bilge and sewer pump out, boat hold pump outs that have been installed throughout Southern California. So we're out there twice a year in the past, once a year nowadays, making sure that those are performing as they are expected to. And folks can relate back to us if there's concerns or questions about their operating through the Pump Out Nav app, which is something that we helped develop with our sister NEP up in San Francisco. Next slide, please. This is actually a shot from last year, not from 2025, but it reminds me that when we start reducing the use of single-use disposable plastics and we replace those with durable, reusable materials, then those benefits keep rolling forward. So this was an effort that was led by LA City Environment, and you had a presentation on this last year, where 120 restaurants had gone through an audit, worked with us, were supported by ourselves as well as the city in building out the dishwashing stations that they may have needed in their restaurant to convert over to this, their bowls, cups, glasses, utensils, all that then provided so that these folks could make that transition. Next slide, please. That's the end of the picture show. Just a couple more stats. The volunteer events on the beaches, we had 27 of those thus far this year. Just over 330 folks came out and joined us, spending just over 765 hours out there assisting us in getting that work done. And again, that's off of Manhattan, Dockweiler, Santa Monica, Westward, and Zuma. I mentioned the butterflies, but I did not mention the western snowy plovers, which are state, I sometimes get this confused, threatened federally endangered within the state of California. And I'm not going to tell you where the nest is right now, but there's one out there. So there are three snowy plover eggs out there on the beach. We'll see if we end up with some chicks here in the next few weeks. And that's what I've got for my report. Thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. And yes, you're always going to have to come back with pictures. With pictures out to this meeting. This is great. Thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome, Martha.
Anyone have any questions for Tom on his report?
Tom, what's the life cycle from fertilization to when you implant the abalone? How long?
Yeah, the fertilization pretty quick. It usually only takes maybe a minute or so for the chemical cue from the release of the eggs of the female for the males to know, oh, we got to get sperm up into the water right now before those eggs would drift away in the ocean and they would not catch up to one another. Part of the challenge with them being so few and far between out there. In our lab where, you know, space is tight, it's usually we get too much sperm and we have to limit how many sperm are getting to an egg in order to get that, to reduce the likelihood of polyspermy and the problems that it creates. 7 days from that point, we've got little baby abalone snails on the ground, and that shell that we were, or those that were passing around, that first bit is still there. So they just add on to this, like growth rings on a tree throughout their life as they increase in size. And it takes us about a year, if we've got some good conditions, fast-growing abalone, before they're ready to go back out into the ocean.
Yes. Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Tom, thank you as always for all of the work you do and the incredible report. I have a question for you. We've obviously just weathered one of the worst algal blooms that we have seen, although we seem to be having them more and more often and worse every year. And so how are those challenges impacting the work you're doing, and how does your work help us mitigate against some of those other impacts and the just devastation that we've seen on some of our wildlife here locally?
Thank you for the question. And if I don't hit on all parts of it, just hold me to it. Certainly, big blooms this year, both of Pseudonyxia, which is a dinoflagellate, and another dinoflagellate called Alexandrium. They produce different types of toxins that manifested differently in interrelated but somewhat separate food webs. I had an opportunity to speak on a webinar with folks from the Marine Mammal Care Center. Certainly have had some conversations with lifeguards with what they've been dealing with and what the public's certainly seen along our coast. Cannot discount that the ash and smoke from the fire was not a contributor to the nutrient loading this year, which may have worsened or expanded spatially that bloom that we saw. But it was not like the biggest bloom ever either. The one that we had that in 2005, 2006 was huge and persistent and far more damaging to the environment. The algal blooms, what they do, aside from the toxins that are produced, which is a very discernible thing, and certainly, you know, very impactful when you see an animal in distress, they, especially in the nighttime when they're not photosynthesizing, they are still respiring oxygen out of the water, and they lower the dissolved oxygen levels sometimes to a point where other animals or themselves can no longer persist. So they deoxygenate the water. When they sink down to lower levels in the bay, the bacteria start to decompose them. The bacteria take more oxygen out of the water during that process as well. So the whole thing really starts to deoxygenate the water column. The light that they're using when they're photosynthesizing during the day, they're absorbing that light, and the light doesn't get down any further. So it puts a lid on top of the bay from a light standpoint, and the kelp can't grow, and the eelgrass can't grow, and the rest of that gets obscured. After that 2005, 2006 algal bloom, you went out to the reefs or into the nearshore sandy environment, and there was seemingly nothing left. That has not been the case thus far this year, fortunately. We have made many runs up to Santa Monica to dive at the breakwater and pier to monitor our sites that have persistent eelgrass off of Malibu. Yesterday was the first day that we were actually able to see because of the amount of material that's still suspended in the water column up there. So there are still some ongoing and pretty profound and wide-ranging impacts. Nutrient reduction into our waters is a key thing. Certainly folks with the sanitation districts here can speak to that as well. If we can start to get our hands around how do we knock down those nutrient levels, our water will be more blue. Our habitats will arguably be more resilient to other stressors, and we'll have a more sustainable coastline.
Thank you, Tom. Any other questions?
No question, Chair. Just wanted to note that virtually we had two members join us, Michelle Persoff of Office Assembly Member Isaac Bryan, as well as Andy Korodesky of Las Virgenes Municipal Water District.
Okay, and then Jenny also. Jenny
and Newland. Jenny.
No. So did apologies. We make, I think we made quorum with Jenny, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you did not drive. We got to quorum.
And just parliamentary procedure, quorum is established, and until someone questions quorum, it is always established. So just please remember that. Thank you.
All right. Okay, so if there are no other questions, we can move on to the next item, which is reports from members on the implementation of the Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, CCMP, the goals and actions of the plan. Do we have any reports from any of our board members? Okay, well, I'm going to share then. I wanted to share with you all that on May 14th, the draft environmental impact report for the Pure Water Southern California was released for public comment. There will be a 60-day comment period. This project is a partnership between the Metropolitan Water District and the LA County Sanitation Districts to take water that is currently going to the ocean, purify that water, and reuse it to replenish groundwater within our region. Today, you'll get to hear on the project that the City of LA is working on, the Pure Water Los Angeles. So thank you for the reps. They're here. So very similar projects. And, you know, the goal here is to make our region more resilient, more drought resilient, use our water locally, rely on less imported water. So we're really excited. Let me know if you are interested in a link to the draft EIR. All the comments are going to Metropolitan. They are the lead agency. We're a responsible agency for this project. So With that, anyone else has something to share? Erica?
Thank you, Martha. Not a specific project update per se, but some of you may remember back in, I'll say February, I did a brief presentation just to help ground us as we were working on the work plan about it needing to meet our statute. So that's Clean Water Act Section 320, executive orders and agency administration priorities. So as we're working on the Comprehensive Conservation Management Plan and updating that over the coming year, and I know staff are already knee-deep, are doing that, those same things apply to that document, which you know, we will work closely with you on, and it does need EPA approval. Any questions?
Thank you, Erica, for update. I don't know if anyone has any questions for Erica. I think Luke was going to share that we are going to start an update of the comprehensive, the management plan. We're looking at potentially streamlining, making, you know, ultimately the work that we're doing isn't changing, but making, you know, updating the document. And as Erica shared, there is some guidance and may have heard some comment in regard to public comment and concern in terms of there is a lot of guidance out there, written, informal. And here I can tell you, Erica has been our EPA staff representative for years. I mean, since I've been attending this commission, she's very knowledgeable in terms of our program, our projects, our activities. So we do look at her for input and advice. So please, you know, consider that. Of course, if you have any questions in terms of these programs, guidance, please contact Luke. Let him know if you have any questions. And you know, we're living through interesting times where there's lots of information, sometimes misinformation, lots of things going on. But ultimately, the work that we do in this commission is very important. These plans do undergo EPA review, and we're trying to navigate the best that we can. And Erica, and today her supervisor is here too with us. You know, they're very important to what we do. They're a great resource. And, you know, I mean, we're doing the best that we can here. So thank you so much for your comments and for all the support that you give our National Estuary Program.
And I could give everybody just a quick preview. So the Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, that is our guiding document, our strategic plan. Everything we work on needs to be contained in that plan. So this is a big update. We will hopefully have something for you to look at later on in the summer. And this is an opportunity to add things to that plan that the commission isn't currently working on. It could be an opportunity to revise some of the things that are in that plan. So, thank you in advance for your engagement on that. We've been working with the executive committee on that document, and we'll be ready to have something for the governing board soon.
Okay, thank you. So if no one else has any other reports, we can move on to the next item, which is consideration of approval of the April 17 meeting minutes. At this time, there's no changes proposed from staff. Does anyone have any revisions to the minutes?
So moved.
Efficient. Okay, is there a second?
Second.
All right, let's do roll call vote.
Apologies, who was the second?
Mr. John
Warren. Okay, thank you.
Warren, okay. All right, thank you, Caitlin.
Okay, one moment while I share the roster. Sorry, a lot of clicking. Okay. So I will be calling members in random order, which is our new process for voting. So John Erickson.
Yes.
Andy Korodesky. Andy, I see your hand raised. You should be able to unmute yourself. You may have to dial *9 or *6. But I will come back, give you a second to figure that out. Jenny Newman.
Yes.
Karen Mogis.
Yes.
Tracy Laverick?
Yes.
Michael Quill?
Yes.
Marcella Benavides?
Abstain.
Warren Ontiveros?
Yes.
Zain Obagi? Tracy Park?
Yes.
EJ Caldwell?
Yes.
Dan Murphy?
Yes.
Greg Rochal?
Yes.
Emily Parker?
Yes.
Martha Tremblay?
Yes.
Sabrina Ashtian?
Yes.
Did I miss any members? Oh, let me go back to Andy. Apologies. It looks like you're unmuted. You might have to, let me see here. You might have to dial *6 on your phone if you're calling in. If you're speaking, Andy, we can't hear you.
Can we follow up with him later in his vote? Or you can type it in.
So just mark as a no answer. Okay, apologies, Andy. We'll have to mark you as a no answer vote. Apologies for that. And the minutes are approved.
Okay, thank you, Caitlin. So we can move on to our next item. So we have a set of information items on the LA County wildfire updates. And I know this is something that Council Member Tracy Park, this is something very important to her, and requested that we do this. And, you know, I think this is the type of, you know, information and tips that we want to hear in terms of the good work that's going on, you know, in terms of addressing challenges. So we do have a series of presentations. So I guess with that, Caitlin, I'll let you introduce the item and the presenters.
Thank you, Chair. So this item was originally scheduled in April, but we ran out of time, and it was scheduled in response to the unprecedented wildfires in LA County, including the January Palisades fire in the Santa Monica Mountains. The impacts from the wildfire have been devastating and far-ranging, and there's a lot of unanswered questions, but we do have some members and partners that have offered to share updates on their efforts to address water quality and restoration in response to the fires. So today we have four updates scheduled. We have an update from the LA Regional Board, State Water Board, Heal the Bay, and Resource Conservation District of Santa Monica Mountains. After each presentation, we'll have a few minutes for member comments. And our goal with this item is to better understand not only the impacts to the wildfire in the bay and its watersheds, but also to inform any new actions or tasks for the update to our strategic plan, the CCMP, which is currently underway, as Luke mentioned. And we will post the slides on our website and send them out with the meeting follow-up email. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jenny Newman, our first presenter and Assistant Executive Officer at the LA Regional Board. Just let me know when to advance your slides.
Okay, thanks, Caitlin. Good morning, everyone. So in the first few days of the fire, well, I'm going to describe our post-fire water quality monitoring efforts. They fall under three general categories. Let's just advance the slide, and I'll go in the order there in the slides. Okay. So in the first couple days of the fire, LA County Department of Public Health reached out to us to do some joint sampling at the beaches to evaluate public health concerns. So public health staff collected the samples, and we analyzed the samples at our lab. We analyzed the samples for metals, nutrients, PCBs, and PAHs, which are chemicals that are commonly found in runoff after fires. We sampled 12 beach sites from Malibu down to Dockweiler State Beach. And county sampled the first four events, and then regional board staff picked up the last two events and did those sampling ourselves. For two of the to the more recent events, we added PFAS, asbestos, and additional volatile organic compounds for sampling or for analysis. And then we added, we've been evolving our sampling plan as we get input from stakeholders. And so then we most recently added hexavalent chromium for our May 1st event. On the February 6th event, we also collected samples from the storm drains or creeks that drained onto four beach sites to get a better idea of what the concentrated runoff was. Next slide, please. And we have the results now for all of those events posted to our website. We compared the results against US EPA risk screening levels for recreation. And this is, it's a calculator, and we used conservative assumptions when coming up with the risk threshold. We assumed adults and children recreating. We assumed that they would be swimming 180 days a year for 4 hours a day. And we also compared the data against our California Ocean Plan water quality objectives for the protection of human health based on the consumption of fish. Next slide, please. And what we found was we detected metals and PAHs at many of the sites. And of those, we only had exceedances of arsenic and the PAHs. For arsenic, it exceeded the EPA recreation risk screening levels at multiple sites. But then the next step in that risk assessment is to compare the results against background. And so we compared the arsenic results in our samples against background levels of arsenic at some natural sites in the Southern California Bight. And the levels at our sites were within the background range. Similarly, at two sites, during just the one event on, I believe it was January 27th, the PAHs exceeded the Ocean Plan fish consumption objective. But again, those were within background levels. And we haven't detected any other VOCs or PCBs in the ocean water samples. Next slide, please. We also began collecting sediment at the request of LA County Department of Beaches and Harbors and on assignment from the Cal OES Task Force in response to the fire. We have had two collection events. One was February 25th to 27th, and the second was April 29th to 30th. For the first event, we collected from Zuma Beach to Rat Beach. And then we added Leo Carrillo to this latest event to serve as a background site because our background levels of these chemicals in sand and soil are background throughout the whole Los Angeles region. So we thought it would be useful to have a more local site. So these Leo Carrillo samples aren't background in terms of time. They're collected after the fire, but they are more outside the fire's impact, the envelope of the fire's impact. So it could be useful as a background site. We sampled for similar chemicals and, again, metals, PAHs, PCBs, focusing on those. Next slide, please. And we posted all our results for the February event and the April event to our website. There were no detections of, many chemicals. Sorry, now I can't see these. But the only chemical that we compared the results against either EPA or California risk screening levels, whichever were more conservative. And we selected residential, so these levels. So these would be levels that EPA and the state determine safe to be in residential soils. So this is a conservative assumption. We wanted to make a protective conservative assumption when making our comparison. So the only constituent that exceeded the risk threshold was arsenic, and it did so again at multiple sites. So the next step is to compare that against background levels. And again, it's the similar result for the ocean water sample. The arsenic exceeded the threshold, but is within the range of background. Arsenic is, a naturally and common occurring metal in, or metal-like substance in the region. And what this means when we say that it exceeds the threshold, but it is below background, that just means that it's very not likely caused by the fire, that it was already there. The next slide shows, I think, the results for April when we added the Leo Carrillo State Beach site. So it's very small, I'm sorry. It's the site that's the furthest to the left, right next to the does it exceed residential screening levels. We have the Leo Carrillo site there. So you can see when we sampled the Leo Carrillo site, it had in the similar range of the detections at the other site. So next slide, please. Okay. And this, again, is just a summary of what I just said. These are some photos of the sand that we sampled. And we sampled the top 2 centimeters of sand to make sure that we're just getting the recently deposited, either from airborne ash that fell on the beach or ash that has washed up again on the beach due to tides. Next slide, please. Okay, so the third effort we undertook was we reached out to the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project to help us coordinate all of the data that we knew multiple agencies were collecting. And with the help of the Ocean Protection Council, we were able to fund a contract for SCORP to coordinate the monitoring of all the government agencies, academic institutions, and nonprofits that are collecting data to ensure that appropriate methods are used and that high-quality data are generated. Also, they got together more on an ad hoc basis early in the first rain events right after the fire to make sure that everyone was following the same procedures, but also to coordinate events so that data gaps could be filled and overlapping sampling could be avoided. And that project is being led by Dr. Alvina Mahinto, and all that information is on our website, which is linked in the first intro slide. And we probably will have a presentation on this, we're hoping, at our September board meeting. So we'll get a presentation on the coordinated monitoring effort. If not September, another very soon board meeting. So thank you, Caitlin. I think that's the end.
Sorry, my screen is frozen.
Okay, it's the end.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Jenny, very much for the presentation and for the regional board's work on this effort. I don't know, Caitlin, are we okay taking, if there are any questions for Jenny, doing them at this time, right?
Yeah, we could take questions at this time.
Any questions for Jenny on the information she provided? Go ahead, Councilmember.
I said thank you for the great work in making this data transparent and available for folks. Thank you again.
Erica?
Thank you, Jenny. The presentation that you mentioned that would happen at your board meeting in the fall, so SCORP would present, is that, or you would give an updated version of what you just shared with us?
Well, I don't think we've invited SCORP yet, so that's why after I spoke, I started hemming and hawing. So whenever SCORP can come and give the presentation is when we'll have the meeting, but also regional board staff will be there as well because they were very involved they are very involved in the project as well.
Greg?
Thank you, Jenny, for your information. I had a couple questions. One is I wasn't really sure if you were seeing additional contamination from the rains I wasn't clear on what your results were from that.
Thank you for clarifying. I did not specify. So some of the events focused on the day or days right after a rain, and then others were dry weather events. The January 27th event in particular was the day after a big rain on the 25th and the 26th. And so that also was the first rain right after the fire. So that gave us, I think, the most correct, as you know, of all of the data we collected, the most immediate response to the fire. And I'm trying to think. I think the February 6th event also followed a rain event, and also the March 13th event. The February 6th and the March 13th event, though, were the 6th event was a few days after the rain. The March 13th event, it had just stopped raining that morning when staff collected samples.
And I'm sorry, what were the results? Did the contaminants go up quite a bit from the rain, and can we expect that, you know, in the future, if we have more rain events, like, and how long do we think that that's going to last?
So we'll present a more comprehensive trends analysis and looking at the difference between the wet and dry weather event. But on the whole, none of the samples exceeded human health-based screening levels, except for arsenic and except for PAHs at a couple sites, particularly the Will Rogers site, immediately after that first rain event. But again, it was expected. That's the kind of thing we expect in the post-fire runoff, and it was also within background. So the results were not as horrible as we feared, but they are still going to be studied to see what we can learn from them. Also, I want to point out we haven't delved deeply into analyzing the data and comparing it against environmental standards, so for the protection of aquatic life and wildlife. So that's the next step.
Any other questions for Jenny?
Yes. I have a question, Jenny. The interagency coordination that's happening here, is there like a framework being set for maybe future wildfires to be able to do a rapid response to those, or are there discussions about that kind of, you know, creating an emergency group that can come together or something?
Yes, those are high level discussions. We did build on work that had already been done in other parts of the state. That's what we based our sampling plan largely on in Northern and Central California, the fires that there's a whole of response framework to fires that we're building on. But for this type of fire, this huge fire right next to the coast, with rain immediately following thereafter, we will definitely add what we've learned here to that larger framework. And yes, that is our plan, so that we can act faster and more efficiently in the future.
Just to kind of add on to that, Cal OES they're very involved in that immediate response. And with every fire, our agencies are extremely practiced in working together in ways that I think can become a model for groups like ours here at this table on how we do things. These operational agencies, the fire departments, don't have the time to wait for a lot of the jurisdictional stuff to get sorted out. And so on the Palisades fire, when I arrived on scene, Santa Monica's fire chief was there with we had a couple chiefs from LA City, a couple chiefs from LA County, and a number of police agencies all kind of showing up and just getting to work and letting the politics sort it out after. And so Cal OES is really good at this post-fire response sort of operation. But one of the things that the people in this room could benefit from would be understanding this liaison process. When the fire begins, we already start having liaison meetings with our partner agencies. And so it was probably, 4 days into it, I think, or 5 days into it, when I reached out to Hilda Bay and said, let's get you on these liaison meetings into the fire zone, meeting with the partners and being present in the room, because these questions are going to start coming up. So For those that aren't already part of the liaison network, when a fire happens and you feel that you should be part of, or your agency should be part of the response, even if we're still dealing with the immediate effects of fighting fire, it's important to be part of those liaison meetings, which happen every morning at the command post. And so this is something where, for those in the room here, when you feel like it's appropriate, you reach out to me and I'll put you in touch with whoever the lead agency is, or you reach out directly through your city and county partners in the fireside to get into these meetings. And it was great to have Heal the Bay there, and it expanded with some other NGOs as we went. And then speaking specifically to Palisades, not Eaton, that was the one that I was involved with. But getting into the liaison meetings early and then tying in with Cal OES when they do their post-fire stuff would be beneficial for all of our partners here at the table.
Dan, thank you very much for that tip and offering that people can contact you. But I think maybe this is something that Luke can follow up to make sure that we kind of have the information and something. I mean, many of us in the table here can have a role depending on what the issue is, what the emergency is. But no, thank you for bringing this up. Yes, Jenny.
I also wanted to thank Dan and the whole emergency management response. I briefly touched on the lessons learned from throughout the state and Cal OES's involvement, but the incident command structure at the state level and the local level acted so quickly, and I personally believe that the water quality results were better because of it, because they deployed best management practices and watershed control measures to control the runoff so quickly. They didn't get them all in place before the rain, because it was like days. But I do think it had an impact, and I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Great. Thank you, Jenny. All right. So next speaker, Caitlin.
Yeah, the next speaker we have is Ashley Doomer, who's joining us remotely. So Ashley, feel free to unmute yourself. Ashley is the Southern California Section Chief of Division of Drinking Water at the State Water Resources Control Board. So she'll be providing some updates there.
Good morning, everyone. For those of you who are not aware, the Division of Drinking Water is responsible for overseeing the Safe Drinking Water Act. So we oversee the public water systems. And in 2017, with the Tubbs Fire, samples were collected of VOCs, and it was found that VOCs were in fact detected after the fire went through. In 2023, AB 541 was signed into law and became effective January 1st of 2024. And this requires the Division of Drinking Water to issue monitoring orders to water systems when they have impacts of fire into their distribution systems. So this monitoring order requires the system to do testing, flushing, notification, and remediation. So for the two fires that occurred, a total of 9 public water systems were impacted and were issued these monitoring orders, 3 in the Palisades and 6 in Eaton. Of those 9 systems that were issued monitoring orders, 4 found VOCs. We had those systems who found the VOCs do extensive testing and flushing, and it wasn't until May 9th that we finally were able to lift the last do not drink notice, and we issued do not drink notices for the systems that were impacted out of an abundance of caution, and as the systems showed to be clear of the VOCs, then we were able to then lift those notices so that the remaining customers could use their water. So definitely a big ongoing effort to get everyone tested and then be able to lift their notices. But the reality is our work isn't done. These systems that were impacted will need to do ongoing monitoring. Obviously, it'll be a while before homes and stuff are rebuilt and the service connections are reestablished. And so the systems will continue to keep an eye on their systems and make sure that no contamination is taking place. Additional flushing is being done, especially because some of these systems had a huge number of the percentage of their homes destroyed in the area. So that usually means you have you can have water quality issues with stagnant water. So having them do additional monitoring and flushing to keep an eye on that. And so that's currently where we're at with our efforts.
Thank you, Ashley, for that information. Are there any questions for Ashley? Tom?
Thank you, Ashley. I was curious, when the flushing of these systems happens, what's the fate of that water? Where does that water get flushed to, perhaps? And the other one that came to my mind is I was curious how long the signal of contamination is clear. How long does it need to remain clear for you guys to then say that it's okay to go?
So when, I guess for the sampling procedure, they have to stagnate the lines for 3 days. And so to draw any contamination out. And then it takes some time before they get the results and stuff. But usually once we get all the results, now they were doing hundreds of samples, right? So it takes time to get all those samples in and stuff. But once we got all the samples and everything was showing non-detect, we were able to then immediately lift. For where the water goes, you know, different, you know, it's 9 different utilities. They have sort of different procedures on how and where that water goes, depending on where it is and things like that. But I think in general, it's usually a surface discharge.
Thank you, Ashley. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, I guess I have a question in terms of the contaminants that you're finding. Is it arsenic also? Is it similar to what?
No, specifically VOCs and really looking at benzene. Benzene was what we found to be the best indicator that contamination has happened. There are some other volatile organics that will get into the water, but benzene, one, our MCL for that is 1. So it's a very low MCL and detection. So that's a good indicator. But that's what we found is kind of the biggest. But yeah, all VOC detections.
Okay, great. Thank you for that, the answer. Any other questions for Ashley? Okay, hearing none. Ashley, thank you very much for your time and your information and for your work on this effort.
Okay, yes, thank you, Ashley. The next speaker we have is Emily Parker of Healed Bay. Apologies, sharing my slides. Thank you. Just give us one moment. There we go. Just let me know into advance.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Caitlin, and good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Emily Parker. I'm today's alternate for Annalisa Moe with Heal the Bay, and I'll be presenting on Heal the Bay's Ash to Action campaign and our post-fire water quality monitoring and response. Next slide, please. So following the devastating urban megafires that swept throughout Los Angeles communities in early January, Heal the Bay, along with many partners, has been trying to understand the impacts on our Santa Monica Bay. And you'll hear a lot of similarities in my presentation today as with the presentation from the State Water Board. So just some quick stats about the fire itself and some photos that were taken by our staff. Next slide, please. So Heal the Bay's water quality scientists collected samples at 10 different beaches prior to the first big storm in late January. And then we also collected post-rain samples at those same locations a few days later. We tested for bacteria, turbidity, PCBs, PAHs, PFAS, benzene, and heavy metals. And for consistency, each sample was collected within the splash zone in knee to chest high water, as you can see in the photo on the slide. Next slide, please. Throughout all of our sampling efforts, we followed all necessary protocols, including a clean hands, dirty hands method to collect the metals samples, ensuring there was no airspace in our benzene samples, and we kept field notes to document everything that was done during our sampling. Once those samples were collected, we kept them on ice until the chain of custody was passed to the physis lab, where they were processed. And you can see some photos on here of that process. Next slide, please. We also collected sand samples from the tidal zone, which are currently being processed by researchers at CSU Northridge. And while we wait for those results, we also have publicly available sand data from the LA Regional Water Quality Control Board to help provide insight into sand quality as well. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned, we tested at 10 different sites throughout the Santa Monica Bay on January 24th and 25th, and then again on January 28th after our first major rain. The highest levels of pollution were observed in the burn area at Big Rock, where the remains of burned structures stand directly within the tidal zone. Also at Topanga Beach, at the coastal access point for Topanga Creek, which is a large drainage from burned open space. And then also at Will Rogers State Beach at Temescal Canyon, which is another drainage closer to high density residential areas that were burned during the fires. Next slide, please. While sampling, our team also did observe many physical hazards in the field, including burnt and twisted metal, damaged concrete, burnt wood with nails, broken glass, and more, as you can see in this photo taken by our team. Next slide, please. All right, so how did our scientists analyze the data that we got back? Again, you're going to hear a lot of similarities from the earlier presentation. We first looked at the ocean plan for marine health limits, particularly for contaminants like PCBs and heavy metals, where even low levels of contamination can interrupt vital biological processes. And this is specifically looking at marine life. It's important to note, though, however, that marine life lives in this water 24/7. They're breathing this water, their food web is immersed in this water. So these limits don't necessarily tell us what the safe limits are for humans who are only visiting these waters occasionally. So next slide, please. So similarly to the Regional Water Quality Control Board, we also used the EPA screening tool, the risk screening level calculator, which allowed our team to create human health thresholds ourselves for recreational contact. This photo on the screen is a screenshot from the recreational water calculator. And while creating these thresholds, we also chose the most protective options. While beryllium poses risk to sea life at just 0.038 micrograms per liter, it is safe for human recreation up to 14.6 micrograms per liter. And this is assuming the most protective, levels, water contact of 182 days of a year, you know, an example of a very dedicated surfer, and is even protective for infants under 2 years old. So next slide, please. The ultimate question, is it safe to swim or surf? No definitive answer yet, but our team is cautiously optimistic. Water quality data indicates that contamination is within risk thresholds or within background levels. And you've already heard this morning what that means when we're talking about background levels. Our data represents the initial deposition of ash pre-rain and the impacts of the first flush following that first big rainstorm. Additional data from the regional board from February that you've already heard a bit this morning captures the larger rain event on February 13th, and even more recent data from March and May provide additional snapshots in time. All of the data that was evaluated indicates low risk based on the thresholds from this EPA tool. However, our team does have remaining questions about inorganic arsenic specifically, which has not been directly tested. All of the testing so far has been for total arsenic, which includes both organic and inorganic. And out of an abundance of caution, Heal the Bay is advising the following precautions to recreators for the time being. Avoid swimming and surfing between Carbon Beach and Topanga Creek or generally within 250 yards of this burn zone or of active debris removal. We also, as always, recommend not entering the water for at least 72 hours following a rain event and keeping an eye out for debris in the water. Next slide, please. All right. All right, one moment. Okay, so Heal the Bay also tested for sand samples, and we can also use that same EPA tool to assess sand as well by looking at the residential soil limits. As with recreational water, we went with the most protective options and used calculations that assume 24-hour-a-day exposure for a full lifetime of 70 years, and again, is protective for all ages, even infants. Next slide, please. So this same million-dollar question, is it safe to visit the beach? Similarly, our sand data indicates that contamination is within health thresholds or within those background levels. So the regional board sampled within the high tide line just as our team did for consistency and specifically targeted the dark sediments deposited on the beaches and flowing from storm drains, of which has, you know, resulted in a lot of concern from the community. But again, we do have some remaining questions specifically for sand. We do need more data on hexavalent chromium, not just total chromium, which is what we've been testing for thus far. And here again, we're advising the following precautions for the time being to beachgoers. We recommend avoiding beaches within the burn area and within 100 yards of the Rustic Canyon outfall at Will Rogers Beach specifically in Santa Monica. We also recommend that parents and pet owners take extra precaution and ensure that children and pets aren't consuming sand when at the beach. We also recommend folks consider wearing shoes if they do choose to go to a beach within the burn zone and are walking near a storm drain outfall. If you see any debris that it clearly came from a burned structure, do not touch it with bare hands. And you may also consider rinsing off after returning home from the beach out of an abundance of caution. Next slide, please. All right, so thus far we've been talking about risks to human health. As I mentioned earlier, risks to marine life are very different because that marine life is in this water all the time. And while water quality impacts from wildfire runoff poses minimal risk to beachgoers at this time, based on our data, it can have a significant impact on the marine life that calls Santa Monica Bay their home. Heavy metals, for example, can disrupt vital biological processes even at relatively low concentrations. And these impacts usually result from long-term exposure, and so the full impacts of this contamination will be known in time. In addition to the water chemistry impacts, fire debris also poses a physical risk to wildlife just as it does for humans. Next slide, please. So as can be seen in these charts on the slide, in January, beryllium, lead, and chromium were above maximum levels for marine life health at multiple locations during both dry and wet weather. Next slide. I want to specifically note that, as you can see circled on the screen here, silver, arsenic, and zinc were also detected above average marine health limits, which could potentially cause long-term impacts if those levels remain persistent over a long period of time. Next slide, please. Okay, so another million-dollar question. Can we consume locally caught fish? So contaminants like metals and hydrocarbons can bioaccumulate in the food chain, which can make fish unsafe to eat for both people and marine life. And in addition, as you heard from Tom earlier, we have been, you know, having a domoic acid and other harmful algal outbreaks, and those outbreaks have resulted in shellfish advisories for all of Southern California. So at this time, Heal the Bay is continuing to caution folks to not eat fish or shellfish caught in the Santa Monica Bay until we fully understand the long-term impacts of the contamination from these fires. Next slide, please. So just a couple of weeks ago, Heal the Bay scientists went out on a boat with divers experienced in navigating contaminated waters, specifically to do some offshore sampling. We collected both water and sediment samples offshore at two locations, at Big Rock and Rustic Canyon. We collected approximately 30 sediment samples and three water samples, which are currently being analyzed by UCLA and USC scientists. Results are still pending, but we can share some anecdotal observations from this sampling event. Divers recovered some large fire debris, including burned wood and metal, as shown in the upper right-hand picture on this slide. And while the water appeared clear and had good visibility at Big Rock, visibility was very poor at Rustic Canyon, and divers observed that the water appeared black at this location and had less than a foot of visibility in the water, so much so that we weren't able to fully complete all of the samples at that site. Next slide. So some next steps for our team and for our work with coordinated monitoring efforts. We, our scientists are going to be doing deep dives into research to better be prepared for future wildfires, continue to analyze existing wildfire monitoring data. We're also working very hard to secure funding for targeted stormwater outfalls in adjacent ocean waters to continue offshore sampling efforts as well. And ongoing monitoring to understand the long-term impacts on marine and human health is crucial, but funding is desperately needed. This is expensive work. Next slide, please. So before I wrap up, I do need to recognize that our work would not have been possible without early and often collaboration from many contributors, of which you've already heard a lot of this morning. Coordination with the LA County Fire Department and lifeguards allowed us safe access to the sampling sites, so extending major gratitude to the team there. Additional sampling was also possible through academic partners with USC, UCLA, and CSU Northridge. And we've also been able to engage in regional efforts to understand the impacts through the LA County Watershed Task Force and the Post-Fire Regional Monitoring Network led by the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. Additionally, this is a cool anecdote. Our aquarium animal team took in 160 federally endangered tidewater gobies from the Topanga Lagoon through a partnership with the Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And those tidewater gobies are actually going to be released back to their home soon. We have a release date, which is really exciting. We are also helping to inform cleanup and rebuilding efforts through contact with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and through our participation on the Blue Ribbon Commission on Climate Action and Fire Safe Recovery. That's all. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Emily. Are there any questions for Emily? I have a question.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know Jenny mentioned arsenic and it's in background, right? And I can see lead, but where's beryllium coming from? You know?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I can't say actually confidently. Okay. Full disclosure, I am not one of the water quality scientists. I am sitting in for them, so I'm not sure, but I can ask Annalisa and see if she knows.
No, that's fine. Because I know in terms of lead, you know, they say that, you know, houses and lead paint, right, that's the source. So I was wondering about beryllium. No, thank you very much.
That's a really good question. I'm curious if any of the other scientists sitting up here might know the answer to that.
Yeah. So it's just maybe in the ad. It's okay. Luke, I think you had a question.
Yes, I had a question for Emily or Dan or Warren. What does beach visitation look like? What are folks doing out there in the burn zone?
In the burn zone, the beach visitation is mostly surfers. We're seeing heavy surf activity at Sunset Point, heavy surf activity at Topanga. The surf activity is limited by parking. The parking lots remain mostly closed or occupied by partner agencies that are working in there. But with street parking and you know, sometimes some guerrilla parking, there's whatever parking can be utilized to surf at Topanga is being utilized to surf at Topanga, and similar issues or similar access at Sunset Point. Further up the coast, the beach activity is kind of limited just because of the fencing around the burned properties and most of the beach access points along the coast have been closed due to stairways and gates being burned and debris and whatnot. But there are a few spaces now that PCH has reopened where the public is accessing the beaches. Rambla Pacifica is one where there's it's not immediately burned on either side. You've got a couple of homes on either side of the beach access, and I've been driving up that way and throwing on the lights and the sirens in the middle of my commute to park the truck in the middle of the road and go run down to the water to rescue some folks. So we are seeing activity, and now that we can see it, where you know there's fewer homes, we can. But it's smaller or lighter than what we had seen in the past. The Will Rogers area is of particular interest. The beach had been a hard closure at just north of the Chautauqua Rustic Canyon area. It's been reopened. The beach itself has no more tape around it, but the parking lots are still limited access. So it's mostly we're seeing heavy bicycle and foot traffic through the area with very limited beach activity in that area. The Bay Club, though, is it's the private club just near between Sunset and Temescal. There is a good amount of beach activity there, and so they are they're reopened, and their members are enjoying the beach. But we're not seeing a whole lot of public access or public use. The access is there. The use is not. The beach camps have all been relocated out of the Will Rogers area, so they're all going to be in Santa Monica and distributed to Zuma and Manhattan Beach where there's space. That's kind of what we've been seeing. It's light still. We do have contingencies in place for staffing the towers if we need it. But at this point, it's been pretty light lifeguard staffing in the Will Rogers area just because we haven't seen the activity come back. We are filling our tower at it's Will Rogers Tower 4 is the one at Sunset Point. That one we staff almost daily due to the surf activity. And Topanga has a full-time lifeguard there 365 days a year. So we do have that. Does that answer for you?
Yes, thank you.
You got it.
Great, thank you. And I think our next speaker on this item, oh, Tom? Yeah.
Both my boys went through the JG program up there, Will Rogers. How'd you guys handle that one?
The kids that were enrolled at Will Rogers, my understanding is that they were given priority registration at whatever, if they were relocated, if they have relocated because of losing homes, they've been given priority access to any of our beaches. We had, as you know, the program is competitive and access and space is limited, but we've increased our staffing and essentially just welcomed the Will Rogers program to move to wherever they wanted at this point. Will Rogers is one of the beaches that we run buses from some of the more inland communities out to that location, and I believe the buses are going to be diverted or we're switching those towards, I think, Santa Monica beaches. It's actually going to be the north end of Venice Beach, I think, is where we've increased our numbers significantly there. But we've also had kind of the Will Rogers diaspora where the residents have moved to other locations. So we've seen increases at Manhattan, Hermosa, El Segundo, and Zuma Beach has seen significant size increases. But as far as new kids coming into Will Rogers, you know, just it's not open. We're not running a program there, so they can pick whatever space we have. But any of the returning kids that had priority at Will Rogers got priority to wherever they wanted to go.
Thanks, Chief.
All right. Caitlin, I believe our next speaker is on.
Yes, our next speaker is Rosie Daggett, Principal Conservation Biologist at the Resource Conservation District of Santa Monica Mountains. Rosie is joining us virtually. Rosie, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. It's lovely to see you all. I'm sorry I was not able to be there in person, but I just wanted to give you a quick update on what the RCD has been doing since the fire. It's been quite a time. Next, please. The Palisades fire is the one that everybody thinks about, but from the point of view of the RCD, the Franklin fire in December was equally as impactful because the critical trout habitat of both watersheds was completely burned. And we lost all the vegetation from the critical habitat upper limits, Ringe Dam in Malibu, and the town of Topanga in Topanga. And so it's the first time in 35 years that both of these creeks have been pretty much offline and not available to support the creatures that they have at one time. Next, please. So the fire as it came, I'm not going to get into too much drama. I just want to say that we have maintained a camera at Topanga Beach, thanks to our partners at the Lifeguard Tower. And this has been super helpful in giving us insights into how the fire directly affected the resources. There's been a lot of information about how it affected all of our communities, our homes, and the people who live and work in these areas, but a little less information has been available for the environmental and ecological resources. Next, please. So I just need to start by saying how much our partners contributed to making all of the activities that I'm about to tell you possible. Over 50 individuals contributed $48,000. USC grant gave us an emergency grant to help rescue the fish. Supervisor Horvath provided an emergency grant to help us do the baseline stream habitat mapping in both Malibu and Topanga, and on and on and on it goes. And there was just really a tremendous amount of effort from many, many people. So I get to tell you the story, but I'm here to tell it because of so many people's contributions. Next, please. So the first thing that we did immediately after the fire was help State Park stabilize some slopes down by Topanga Lagoon. Last year in the rains, the slope that you're looking at right now dropped, eroded 20 feet and dropped two of the cabins into the creek, or actually it was one cabin and some extra stuff into the creek. So we wanted to make sure that the slopes were holding. Next, please. And we were, NOAA at State Parks was able to get the National Guard to come out and help. And so with NOAA and our biology technician, Isaac Yelchin, we were able to help direct the National Guard. There were 100 guardsmen out. And in one day, they installed all of this material that the RCD had helped State Parks acquire. And this became really important because, as you saw in the original photo, EPA took over the burned areas of the Ranch Motel, which is one of the banks, and then where the other businesses were on the west side of the creek. So having this slope stabilization was actually critical for their work as well. Next, please. So before the rains came, we realized we had to get all of the fish that we could out of the creek. And so with our partners at CDFW and National Marine Fisheries, I basically cashed in every favor I could ever get from all of my fish friends. And we actually had people coming from San Diego and Santa Barbara down to help us. And it was an amazing effort coordinated with four teams working in different sections of the creek. and we were able to get about half of the fish that we knew were in the creek out of the creek and rescued. Next slide, please. And as you could see from the previous slide, the slopes were really unstable. So we basically caught the fish and then hand carried them with buckets up the banks because people couldn't walk up and down the banks without the banks failing. So that's the crew. There's a picture of the fish. And we initially took the fish to the Fillmore Hatchery, but they weren't really very happy there. And in 2021, Arroyo Hondo, which is a conservancy-owned property on the Central Coast, they were burned and all of their fish were destroyed and lost in the aftermath of their fire. So the rains had cleared it back out again. The habitat was accessible and we were able to get the trout moved to Arroyo Hondo. That also entailed many trips with buckets because we had to carry the fish about a mile through the creek over waterfalls to get them up to the refugia pools. But much to our great delight, the fish were able to reproduce and spawn this year despite the alien abductions that they had withstood. And we had over 100 babies, which is really wonderful. So we don't know when we're going to be able to bring the trout back to Topanga and potentially to Malibu as well. But we know now that we've got a population that's there and will be reproducing, hopefully, and stable for the next couple years so that we can bring them home in a few years. Next, please. And we also have a similarly hopeful story with the tidewater gobies, which was another endangered fish present at the Topanga Lagoon and Lower Creek area. And this was an effort that was coordinated with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and our partners at Cal State University Channel Islands, Dr. Brenton Spees. He had a lot of connections with Aquarium of the Pacific and Heal the Bay. Next, please. And so we were able to do an emergency transfer. Heal the Bay took 163 gobies. And I actually went to see them last week and it was hilarious because these gobies are really enjoying their vacation in the in the tanks and they've been eating very nicely. So they're all chubby and it's pretty hilarious to see. That's been wonderful. And next, please. The Aquarium of the Pacific took the bulk of the gobies because they have a bigger situation. We're able to accommodate more. And they've been doing some really cutting edge research with our gobies while they're in captivity because our population from Topanga was in the wild infected by a fungal species called Microsporidia. And there is no real known treatment of how do you stop this disease? Can you make it less lethal? How do we handle this? And so U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the aquarium did an amazing job with an experiment to look at different treatments. And I'm happy to report that everybody is still alive and well, and that pretty soon we'll be able to get these fish back into their wild home because they're getting to breeding season at this time. Next, please. The other big ticket item that took a lot of time was monitoring water quality. And the RCD has been monitoring the three sites you see starred here since 2019. The main lagoon site we've been monitoring since 2005. Next, please. And what was really interesting was to see the impact of the sedimentation on the lagoon and on the water quality. So if you look at the picture with Brenton, what you see is immediately after the fire and the lagoon was still connected to the ocean and the water level was really low. And you can see from the sediment deposition, that's pretty much what the whole creek looks like, a bowling alley with a little bit of water on it. All the in-stream habitat has been filled in and the level of the creek bed has risen between 4 and 8 feet in different places of depending on the slope. And last week, we went in, and at this point in time, the lagoon has closed, is no longer connected to the ocean, and we ended up having to do our water quality by swimming. And so you see our watershed stewards member, Dre, on the kayak. She had to swim to those locations, and I carried all the equipment on my kayak so that we could do this. It was pretty hilarious, but the day, you know, you got to get the data. Next, please. So we have been contributing all the data that we collect to a consortium that the LA Regional Water Quality Control Board contracted SQRP to pull together as much information as possible. We provided some of our pre-fire data as well as what we've been collecting since the fire. We're doing pretty much only nutrients and turbidity as well as in situ grab sample stuff. But we also took the opportunity to collect sediment samples at all three of those locations, which were upstream of the EPA sites, adjacent to the EPA sites, and then downstream of the EPA sites. And I just handed off all those sediment samples to UCSC. There's a environmental toxicologist up there, Christine Richardson, who's going to be studying the sediment samples from that lens. And then Christine Whitman from Cal State Long Beach. She and her team are going to be looking at the sediment samples from a total carbon and biodiversity point of view. And we're hoping to have that data available to share with everyone and help inform our understanding of how water quality changed in response to all of the activities, both the firefighting as well as the post-fire EPA stuff. But so far it looks pretty good. Next, please. The other thing that we've been doing that's really important is setting up photo points along Topanga Canyon Boulevard, where we can monitor pools that we've been looking at and have had mapped as refugio pools since 2001 when we started our long-term study in Topanga Creek. Next, please. And so what we've been doing is looking at what's happening in the creek. And this is one of the areas where at the lower level of the creek, where you can see that the slope is, this is basically alluvial fan type area at the bottom of the canyon, about half a mile upstream from PCH. And this is where we used to have pools and runs to support our life cycle monitoring station, where we were deploying a Didson camera and fike nets and weir traps to monitor the ingress and egress of steelhead over time. As you can see, there are no pools left, and that water is about 3 inches deep. Next, please. One of the other main refugia areas is located almost 2 miles up the creek. And what I'm showing you here is the 12-foot tall bank of material deposed in this section of the creek. This used to be a series of step pools that was critical habitat breeding for California newts, as well as our steelhead. As you can see, there's nothing left of that at the moment. Next, please. And this is a sycamore tree that is identifiable in photos of Topanga Canyon Boulevard going back to the 1980s, when this whole stretch of the road blew out as well. And it's a really iconic tree. And for many people who travel through Topanga, you know, this is the tree that tells them that they're coming home as they're driving up the boulevard. And during the last big rainstorm we had in February, the whole bank downstream of that tree blew out and its roots were totally exposed and hanging in the air. And we were really afraid that the tree would fail and fall. So working with the Caltrans team, their geologist and arborist, and their contractor, Flow Engineering, who did an amazing job of helping us put material back in so that we could stabilize this tree. And the good news is that it's hanging in there and looking pretty good. There is a culvert nearby, and we just on Monday discussed the plan on repairing that culvert, which will be modified so that none of the roots remaining will be impacted, which is a really great thing. And I kudos to both Caltrans and their contractors for working with us to make that happen. Next, please. And some of the other species that were impacted by the fire and the flood are things like monarchs, which you don't necessarily think about, but the eucalyptus trees that you see on the left were an overwintering roost site. We didn't get many. None of the roost sites down here get a lot of monarchs, but we definitely were seeing them very regularly. And so we've now partnered with State Parks and the Xerces Society to pull together some funding that will allow us to weed that whole area and replace the euphorbia and mustard with pollinator plants. And so our team has started the weeding. You can see that in the lower right. And we're anticipating carrying that through with volunteers as soon as access is a little better. And hopefully in the fall, we'll be able to get in there and plant the pollinator plants to help support the monarchs in addition. Unfortunately, these eucs are not really coming back that quickly. So we'll be paying attention to that as well, hopefully trying to boost those trees' recovery. Next, please. And back a little bit to Malibu. Everything from Ringe Dam down to the town of Malibu burned on both sides of the canyon. And what you're seeing here is a pool that's usually at the location where our divers are standing, about waist deep. And the sediment deposition in this pool has reduced the volume of water available. And so there's quite a lot of change in this. So in anticipation of assisting with the eventual and hopeful removal of Ringe Dam, we're going to be going back in here and doing a longitudinal habitat profile, which we can then compare to the one that we did in 2017, which was prior to the Woolsey fire. So we'll have some understanding of levels of accretion, where our refugia pools survived and where they don't. And that should be very helpful to the sediment modeling as they think about where to put the sediment that's currently trapped behind Ringe Dam. Next, please. And last but not least, we have been doing oak restoration in partnership with State Parks since 1995. The site that you're looking at in this photo was one that we've been working on since 2019. And if you look closely, you can see a little pink flag sort of in the center to the right of this image. And yes, thank you. And that's one of the baby oaks that we had planted in here because there was a natural die-off due to western oak bark beetle and the drought. And so we were trying to recover connectivity in this fragmented oak woodland. And the fire came right to the road, the fire road that's adjacent to this location. And so the fire crews went in with bulldozers and they bulldozed this our whole site. And that little flag that you see is the only oak tree remaining of all of our baby oaks, some of which were 5 feet tall. That was quite devastating to lose about 200 of the 300 oaks that we had been nurturing. And I just give kudos to Alyssa Morgan, who's taken over the management of this project. And she's been working very hard with the State Parks crew to go back in, and we've been replanting and restoring. And so hopefully we'll jumpstart this and keep it going for another couple of years to get those, the new ones established. So just in summary, there's a lot of work that's still continuing, and we've been extraordinarily grateful to all of our partners for helping us support this work. And as much as it's important for us to think about how we restore our human communities, I think it's equally as important for us to remember that we have to restore and take care of our ecological communities too. So with that, I just want to thank you, and I hope you can see we've been busy and we've really appreciated the opportunity to do that. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosie, for your presentation and all the wonderful work that you're doing. Are there any comments? I think Tracy wanted to say something.
Before I do, are there any questions for Rosie? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you to all of you. I know I was here quite a number of months now, and I guess this is the advantage of having this presentation now, where we can show how far we've come in a lot of these areas. And I know all of our organizations have been working quite hard through this time. Special thank you to Rosie, who has pulled all of this together, and for her presentation today. But one of the things we've learned in this fire is the importance of being interconnected with our agencies, interconnected with our communities, and interconnected with the wildlands that are all around us and that are an important reflection of how we are moving forward to recover from this fire. So thank you for all of that. We'll continue our work. And thank you again for your support and the support of the community, for all of you out there that heard our plea for funding to conduct these studies. These are emergency procedures that we're pulling together, and they are not cheap, and they are not already funded. They're outside of current grants. So anytime you do donate to something like that, it really, really affects our ability to do it. It really helps us out. So appreciated. We had a huge public support this year, and so thank you to the public for reaching out.
All right. Thank you. And with that, I think there were no other questions for Rosie. We can move on to the next item. We're a little behind schedule, but we'll try to catch up. Caitlin, do you want to introduce?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. So this item is a presentation on Pure Water Los Angeles, which is a long-term program created to develop a new local drinking water supply by producing purified recycled water from wastewater treated at Hyperion. And it's a collaboration between LA Sanitation and Environment and LA Department of Water and Power. And this effort aligns with Action 21 of our CCMP, our strategic plan, which is to essentially reduce reliance on imported water sources and promote reuse, recycling, and advanced wastewater treatment. So with that, I will invite Christina Jones and Johan Toriledo to the... Oh, you're already there. And let me get your slides up. And you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for inviting us today. It's a pleasure to be here. Lots of really good information and presentations, so we thank you for the opportunity to present on our program, but also to learn about some really interesting research and a lot of great work that is happening in the area. My name is Johan Toriledo. I work for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. I'm one of the team leads that sees the day-to-day operations for Pure Water Los Angeles. And we also have Christina Jones that's going to be joining me in a bit. She represents Los Angeles Sanitation and works specifically at the Hyperion facility. Our goal today is to illustrate the benefits of Pure Water Los Angeles, which is a large-scale water recycling program, by showcasing not only what needs to be implemented, but also why we're doing this, and that why it really aligns with a lot of the information that we've heard here today is basically to improve the sustainability for Los Angeles and the region while enhancing the environment. To me, this is something that's very important because Pure Water Los Angeles is a program that's going to leave a legacy, And being the father of a 9-year-old, and I'm sure a lot of you could relate to that, this program is really going to benefit a lot of our future generations in Los Angeles. Next slide, please. In today's agenda, I will be covering the background. I'll talk a little bit about the strategy for the program and program details. Next slide, please. So before talking about the program, I really want to take a step back to talk a little bit more about the sources of supply that we get. In this image, you'll be able to see exactly what the supplies are for Los Angeles, and they're really divided into three main categories. The first one is historical imports, which is illustrated by the dark blue line, and this basically pertains to water that comes from the Los Angeles Aqueduct. The second one is the imported purchase, which is illustrated by the light blue line, and that pertains to water that comes either from the Colorado or from the State Water Project. And then lastly, local supply, which is illustrated by the circle, and it pertains to conservation, stormwater capture, and recycled water efforts in Los Angeles. But why is this important? Next slide, please. In terms of the makeup of supply, if you look at the image to the right, you'll be able to see that roughly about 90% of our supplies come from imported sources. That basically means that only about 10% of our supplies are locally produced. The fact that most of our supplies are imported really makes us vulnerable to a lot of risks that include environmental regulations, seismic risks, and climate change considerations. Some of those risks have become a reality recently. We've had drought, we've had fires, we've had also the rising cost of water. And while DWP is taking steps in really maximizing local supplies through stormwater capture and groundwater usage via remediation projects, one key solution to mitigate supply challenges is to maximize local supply. And how do we do that? Through programs such as Pure Water Los Angeles. This is the true power of Pure Water Los Angeles. This will really be a mitigation tool that enhances reliability, sustainability, and resiliency. The program has potential to provide up to 230 MGD, a million gallons per day, of supply to the city of Los Angeles. The supply will be sourced from sanitation facility called Hyperion, which is located by Dockweiler Beach. And DWP will provide the conveyance and final treatment for the supply. As a point of reference for all of you, our 5-year average of supply to the city of Los Angeles has been roughly 430 MGD. Next slide, please. And at this time, I'd like to bring up Christina to talk a little bit about wastewater.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Christina Jones. I'm an environmental engineer with LA Sanitation Environment. I'm just going to do a brief background on our service area. So we're going to be talking about the blue shaded area on the map on your screen. This is Hyperion's sewer shed. So we serve in that area a wide, diverse area within LA City. And there are three treatment plants located within that sewer shed, Donald C. Tillman and LA Glendale, and then Hyperion. The geography of the sewer system here makes it such that Hyperion is at the end of the line, and it is also the last place that sewer touches before anything hits the ocean. So Hyperion is a very important piece of infrastructure within our sewer shed system. And it's also the largest, one of the largest in the country. So we treat on average 270 million gallons per day of wastewater. So that's roughly 409 Olympic-size swimming pools every day of wastewater that we treat. This represents a very large opportunity for the city. Next slide, please. Because what that would translate to if we did recycled water is roughly half of the city of Los Angeles's need for drinking water. So this program is born out of this natural system that we already have and this opportunity that Hyperion can present. And it's a collaboration between our department, LA Sanitation Environment, and Department of Water and Power. And it's going to be delivering a lot of different benefits. And it's going to take a little bit of time, of course. And it's actually a very big program that's already heavily underway with a lot of planning efforts. Next slide, please. So this slide is something we commonly use in our presentations as we're going to the public to help illustrate the connection between our drinking water system and our sewer system and the advanced water purification facility, highlighting that monitoring happens throughout. And as evident also with a lot of your presentations today, monitoring is very important. So we're going to get into a little bit more details of the program in the next slide. Johan?
Thank you, Christina. Again, just to emphasize what Christina related, our program is really looking into putting One Water Act into action. And there's two main key takeaways. We want to be able to maximize recycled water to benefit the Santa Monica Bay, while also creating a local renewable source of supply for Los Angeles. And public safety is very important. And as Christina mentioned, we aim to monitor 24/7 to basically make sure that we comply with all the pathogen and chemical reduction levels that have been established by the Department of Drinking Water in California to make sure that, again, we continue to provide public safety at the core of the program. LADWP and LA Sun understand that all legacy programs must have a clear purpose. And for Pure Water Los Angeles, that is very simple. We want to be able to diversify our water supply to enhance reliability, resiliency, and sustainability. And you'll hear that as a common theme for the program. Those three things are really what are at the core of the program. Our vision is to increase local supplies to maximize the production of purified recycled water, to mitigate risks from climate change, seismic events, and to do this in an equitable and affordable way. And our mission is to partner across the region to build world-class infrastructure to replenish the groundwater basins and to support the future's direct potable reuse applications. As a point of reference, between the three major basins in Los Angeles, which include the West Coast, Central Basin, and San Fernando Basin, there's roughly 1 million acre-feet of water that could be stored in there. That's basically 2 years' worth of supply for Los Angeles, and we could do this without having to build a dam. So that's one of the true powers of the program, if we're able to implement this through indirect potable reuse. Next slide, please. So you've heard right now of why we're doing it, but how do we bring that purpose to life? And this is where the goal and the strategy come in. Our goals are really milestones into the journey, and some of the goals you see here on the slide. The first one, again, is to maximize recycled water reuse from Hyperion, construct and upgrade cost-effective infrastructure, diversify a water supply portfolio, provide resiliency, reliability, and sustainability, enhance the ecosystem health, which is something that we heard about from other presentations, and lastly, to provide community and equity benefits. Our holistic approach for this is the graph that you see on the left. The water, again, it's sourced from Hyperion, which is the blue dot located near Playa Vista. Through infrastructure that will be built by DWP, the supply will be conveyed to various buckets in the region. So some of those buckets that we aim to provide supply to include the groundwater basins that I previously mentioned, reservoirs throughout the city, partnerships, such as developing a partnership with the Pure Water Southern California program, and most importantly, to be able to make a connection to the Los Angeles Aqueduct Filtration Plant, which is shown by a yellow dot to the north. That is a key piece of infrastructure because that will allow us to convey the supply equitably through the city of Los Angeles, given that that facility has access to roughly 70% of our customers. Next slide, please.
So we've told you about the program now, but how are we going to go about doing this? For those of you that have not visited Hyperion before, this is an aerial view of our plant. It's the area to the left of up on the picture shows mainly our digesters. So if you're flying out of LAX, this is usually the most noticeable thing from the airplane, for example. This side of the plant won't be touched much by our construction activities. And this is mainly where we do we have our headwork system, and we also have our preliminary and primary treatment. The area on the picture to the right where you see the shaded areas, this is phases 1, 2, and 3. And this is where our current secondary system currently lives, and also where some of our pilot projects are, which I will get into in a minute. But this is where the predominant amount of construction will be taking place at Hyperion. This phasing is been recorded in our program implementation plan, and Johan will give you guys the website later. But this document really looks at our treatment process existing at Hyperion, how we can go about phasing construction and bringing these different elements of the program to Hyperion if we were to do full advanced treatment on site at Hyperion. All these are still a little bit of outstanding questions just because we have to consider a lot of different aspects and different elements for community concerns and considerations. So we are going through a CEQA process, so this is part of what's going to be considered. On this slide, though, you can see an illustration of what, if we were to do full treatment at Hyperion, what it could look like. This would all be done while we are maintaining operations at Hyperion to maintain our NPDES compliance and continue treating 270 million gallons of wastewater every day. So there's obviously a lot of planning that did go into creating, albeit a simple picture on a slide, but this is how we would get to the potential 230 million gallons per day of advanced treated recycled water in the future. Next slide, please. In addition to these planning efforts that are mainly through a document and through a series of technical memos, we also have two projects on site at Hyperion currently right now. If you wanted to go see them today, I could take you, for example. They are both distinct projects. Sometimes the names get mixed up. They are somewhat like pilots. One is a proof of concept, though, and one is truly a pilot. The Hyperion Advanced Water Purification Facility is the project that will be producing 1.5 million gallons per day of recycled water that will be used by the airport across the street. I think this project might be of particular interest for you all today. And this project, the picture is not a rendering. This is actually a real-life photo of the project site. Construction completed more than a year ago, and we are completing our commissioning and activities and startup activities, and we are reviewing our 7-day acceptance test, which will be going to DDW staff soon, I hope, so that we can hopefully work with the regional board and complete the required steps for our permit so that we can start delivering water to the airport. The airport's also completing some final documentation steps with some engineering reports for all their systems that they will be using it at within LAX, because they will be using it for toilet flushing as well as their cooling tower, which is going to be providing air conditioning to the airport. So it's an exciting update for this project. It's been a long time in the making. This project, though, was done through an alternative delivery method, and it was really advantageous, at least from my perspective, because we were able to construct, build, site prepare, and design this whole thing within a matter of a few years. So it's a great option that we will be looking to replicate in the future. The project on the right, the membrane bioreactor pilot facility, this project is different because it does not have a customer. This project is more for research purposes, and we will be testing three different membrane vendors on site and putting it through different scenarios to figure out what product can meet the needs best at Hyperion, because as you all may already know, the wastewater we receive at Hyperion is specific to our location, and of course testing is very important for that reason, because we need to make sure that what we plan on implementing in the future program will actually work, and the MBR pilot facility is really how we're going to sort that out and hopefully gain the required regulatory approvals for the future program. This project is construction's completed. We are in the process of constructing some odor facilities associated for the project. So hopefully that'll be done this year and we can start testing late this year, early next year. Next slide, please. Probably the favorite slide perhaps for this group. We didn't talk too much about the technology we're planning on implementing as part of the program, but MBR is of course a very big thing for us for the future DPR and IPR plans that we have for the program. Some research has been done about what implementing MBR at Hyperion could look like as far as water quality impacts. I believe this might be of particular interest to you all. So this is some numbers that I have on the slide here, and we are really looking forward to implementing MBR because of the benefits it will provide to the Bay. And we have a lot more information on this. Again, in full disclosure, I am not the water quality expert. I'm the program management and project management side of things. So, of course, if more information is desired, we can definitely get that to you. But we are very interested in this and continuing our review of removing nutrients from the Bay. That's something that Sanitation cares very much about, either through this program, Pure Water Los Angeles, or through other efforts. We are working on that. And with that, I'd like to hand it back to Johan.
Thank you, Christina. So as part of the program strategies, our team has evaluated roughly three approaches, which were narrowed down to two, and it's what you see on the right. Approach two pertains to what we call indirect potable reuse, or IPR, with post-AWPF DPR. Basically, what this means is that we aim to not only maximize the production of water from Hyperion, but we aim to do it in an affordable way, What does that mean? That we want to treat from the start by doing indirect potable reuse so that we can introduce that water to the specific buckets, which are the groundwater basins. And we will do the final polishing at the Los Angeles filtration plant that gives us access to 70% of our population. This is really a good way, again, to keep the cost down because we're treating up to the desired level of use. The other approach, which is approach number three, that pertains to doing the DPR at the beginning. Obviously, this means that we'd be injecting a water quality which is higher than what is needed for the groundwater basins, but we still be compliant with both IPR and DPR regulations. Something that is important here is that we're currently going through the evaluation process to determine which of the two approaches make the most sense. And what I want to mention to you is that approach one, which was an indirect potable reuse program only, that was screened out because it didn't meet the vision or the mission of the program, which is what? To maximize the amount of water that we want to get from Hyperion. If we would do an IPR program only, we would not be able to do that. The amount of volume that would be using is minimal. On the left, you're able to see a schematic that outlines more or less the various alignments that we're considering through our CEQA environmental documentation. From Hyperion, we aim to basically go towards the east to provide supply towards Central Basin and to create a partnership with Pure Water Southern California. And to the north, there are three alternatives that are currently being evaluated to, again, have access to the San Fernando Valley as well as the Los Angeles filtration plant, which is located to the north. Next slide, please. So what is included in Pure Water Los Angeles? This slide basically shows the implementation projects that are required to build this program. There are roughly 30 unique projects that need to be constructed to be able to implement the program to its full scale, which is roughly 230 MGD. The implementation of these projects will require anywhere from 70 to 80 acres of real estate in the city of Los Angeles to be able to build this, plus including right-of-ways for the trunk lines. As you see here in the chart, you need to build an indirect potable reuse purification facility, trunk line, roughly over 40 miles of large diameter pipelines, and I'm talking about 8 to 9 foot diameter, pump station, roughly 3 new facilities, storage tanks, 3 roughly 9 million gallon tanks, a direct potable reuse facility, groundwater treatment so that once the water is either injected or spread, we could pull that out and serve it to our customers, well fields, and obviously power improvements. A lot of these facilities will have power demand, and we're coordinating with our power system to be able to provide clean energy through the LA100 initiative to be able to power this new initiative. Lastly, as Christina mentioned, Hyperion. Hyperion needs to be modernized. Plant upgrades are required, including the MBR conversion to start doing some of the early efforts. The estimated program cost that you see here from $20 to $25.8 billion that pertains to approach two, the IPR, to approach three, which is the DPR from the start. Our annual operation and maintenance cost is anywhere from $405 to $462 million. Next slide, please. Program benefits. I recently came across a quote by an English writer called Douglas Adams, who was also an environmentalist, and he said that to give real service, you must start something which cannot be bought or measured with money. And that really resonated to me because for us, infrastructure is not only about building the projects and leaving something behind, but it's also doing something greater that's really going to benefit the community in various ways. And this slide has a lot of information as to how we're looking at Pure Water Los Angeles through a programmatic framework to be able to provide other benefits. And there are three that I'd like to highlight here. The first one is equity. The program is not only going to create new infrastructure, but we want to leave a legacy behind as we build through our communities. We want to be able to beautify the built environment by enhancing parks, beautifying streets, working with communities to provide a real social benefit. Business and workforce development is another benefit for the program. As a result of the investment, which you saw before, we're going to be able to generate lots of jobs. As far as capital investment, we've estimated that we could create roughly up to 180,000 new jobs in the city of Los Angeles. When you look at the amount of cost for operation and maintenance, we'd be able to establish roughly 2,000 new permanent jobs in the city of Los Angeles. That's a lot of benefits for our constituents, the people that live here in Los Angeles. And then the other benefit that I wanted to highlight is what Christina mentioned, benefits to the Santa Monica Bay. Today we heard about the abalone. Obviously, removing the nutrient level is going to be very beneficial for all the species in the ocean. Next slide, please. The program has continued to grow and evolve, but we're really early in the process. There are lots of program decisions that need to be made, including the alignments. How do we basically get our supply from Hyperion all the way to the north into the different buckets? What is the treatment option? Are we going to be starting with IPR from the beginning, or are we going to be doing DPR? And that requires a lot of assessment because of the cost that I mentioned. There are lots of technical studies, stakeholder engagement, partnerships, and other key actions that are needed to move the program forward. One item that I want to mention right now that is very critical is our CEQA environmental report. We're working on that. We aim to be completing that by next year. And one key deliverable that you'll be seeing in the next 2 months is the notice of preparation. That's going to be released roughly by July and August. So that'll be kind of like the first step in going to the community. We had done CEQA work previously when the programs were divided into Operation X and Hyperion. But acknowledging that the program has evolved and we are now a joint initiative, we're kind of restarting that process again, because outreach is very important to us and we want to do it in an equitable manner. Again, all these components that you see here are really what are going to help us shape the program to get us to move in the right direction. Next slide, please. Okay, so by now you heard about like the technical information, but how do we communicate the information to the public? Our communications team has really done a great job in our program webpage. We basically revamped entire information, and this website includes general information on outreach, key document, including DWP's master plan for Pure Los Angeles, as well as sanitation's program implementation plan that basically looks at how feasible it was to modify and reconvert the Hyperion facility to be able to provide water to the filtration to the advanced purification facility. The website also includes information about upcoming events, stakeholder engagement meetings, community meetings, and information for the CEQA. So I do encourage you to go out there, register, and join us for any of these events that we have. As a general metric, to date, we've done roughly about 180 presentations since the program first started, and audiences go from council district, politicians, academia, schools, etc. Christina has additional information on outreach that she wanted to share.
Oh, I just wanted to encourage all of you, if you have anyone you would like us to come do a presentation to or have a meeting with, we do appreciate those kind of requests. But we have had a few community meetings in the last month. There has been two, and we will be having scoping meetings coming up for the programmatic EIR, hopefully in the next month. So lots going on. But I think that concludes our remarks for today.
Yes, next slide, and that was the last. We're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Johan and Christina. And I know we're really behind schedule now. And I know Councilmember Park wanted to make a brief statement before leaving.
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I will have to leave shortly. But I wanted to really thank everyone for the presentations today, especially the really thoughtful work that has already been done and the discussion today of the issues related to the Palisades fire and the recovery. As the council member for City of Los Angeles who represents the Pacific Palisades and is a caretaker of our beautiful Santa Monica Bay and our gorgeous coastline, the work that has occurred over the last 5.5 months really is nothing short of extraordinary. I wanted to share with you that just as of today, the Army Corps of Engineers has hit 75% completion on residential debris removal. We've had incredible success in partnering with FEMA in getting their agreement and support to help us with debris removal for our mobile home communities and owner-occupied multifamily. They have also identified now some commercial properties that they're going to be assisting with to help us achieve our shared goal of promptly getting every last piece of that debris up and off the ground so that we can put as quick of a stop as we can to the ongoing environmental contamination and clear the pathway for rebuilding. I wanted to really acknowledge the work of so many partners, both before and after the rains in the early days of the fire. My team and I from CD11 were on the ground immediately assessing unstable hillsides, broken infrastructure, working across multi-jurisdictional task forces to share that information, and working with those immediate remediation measures that went into effect. That work has continued to grow and expand over time, and absolutely none of that would have happened without the cooperation and collaboration of our government and non-government partners. I personally had the opportunity to spend time with Tracy Quinn, the executive director from Heal the Bay, who also happens to be my constituent from the Pacific Palisades. She and I were on the ground together in the Palisades, up on bluffs and hillsides, along the coastline in Malibu, literally climbing over debris, looking at places that needed immediate intervention. And you all have just been an incredible friend and partner in all of that. The debris removal for the burned homes along the coastline in Malibu, I have always been of the opinion should have been done on day two. I wish those efforts had started sooner, but I am pleased to report that that work continues and remains underway. As we look to the future and think about not only the rebuilding of the Pacific Palisades, the investment in the long-term sustainable infrastructure that we need to protect and preserve our coastal environment continues to be top of mind. We are looking at regional authorities and incremental tax financing models that will help us make those investments. And I hope across agencies and layers of government, our watershed is one of the top priorities. I personally see how the impacts of all of this have changed our coastline and harmed our wildlife. It's just, as the recipient of the watershed for the entire region, all of that toxins and garbage and pollutants and trash, and then add on top of that the debris and materials from the burn scar, that all moves through our waterways and ends up right on our sand, on our beaches. That just can't be how we manage watershed in 2025 for the next century. So that, among other things, I look forward to working with you all on. I'm encouraged to hear that the algal bloom seems to have abated in many respects, and we're starting to see our wildlife population stabilize and recover. But I think for all of us who care about our environment, some of those images that we saw in these last few months have been a real wake-up call. And I know, you know, the debate remains ongoing about whether and to what extent the fires contributed to or added to it. I don't know how anyone looking at it can't know that it's all interconnected, and no matter what, it's not good. And so thank you all for your continued focus and your dedication to these major issues. One of the things that my team and I did early on also was work with Hyperion and LA Sanitation. We were very concerned about pools and contents in pools and the impacts that that could put on our sewer system. The last thing we wanted to see were our bulkheads jamming up and any more discharges or other issues compounding those problems. We have major, major underground infrastructure work that we're going to be doing. We'll be coming out to the community with the Department of Water and Power to talk about some of the water pipes and drainage issues that we see in the region. And so I just, again, wanted to thank you all for those reports and presentations today. I know that across constituencies from Malibu and destinations north through my council district to the South Bay and beyond, our shared love of and interest in protecting our coastline and our sensitive environmental areas is paramount to all of us. So please always continue to know that CD11 is here as a partner and an ally in all of the work ahead. So thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Thank you for your leadership. So we have one item, so I can give a couple of options. It's a brief item. I think Caitlin and Luke said it can be done in 10 minutes, Or so if you, you have some additional time, we can do that. Or we can just carry it on for our August meeting. At that time, you can hear the update in terms of the work that was done. And then we'll be talking more about the comprehensive management plan, right? You'll maybe have a refresher as Luke and Caitlin share about the annual plan work. And so it could be a good tie-in. So it is 11:57. So in any preference, let's have it in August or stay a few more minutes to give them a chance to provide us a presentation. Sabrina?
Is there any benefit or anything that Luke and Caitlin, you need from us today to hear that today, or do you have a preference?
No preference from us. This is an informational item, so, you know, we don't need a quorum. If folks do need to leave, you're welcome to.
Okay. Any other thoughts? We do it in August or hear it now? August? Yeah? Okay.
I was going to say, yeah, I'm happy to stick around, but...
So let's do it in August, since we'll be refreshed. Well, and it'll be good. You know, you can hear about that, and we can talk about it in the executive committee too. So there's no closed session. So we don't need to take a vote or anything, right, in terms of continuing the item, Eric, for August?
Yeah, that's item? Correct. We can we'll mention it during the executive committee meeting in July. Agendize it for August.
And Luke, is there anything written? Is the report itself written, a written report that maybe you can email to the group so that you guys can look at it, so that in August, you know, it'll just be a refresher too?
Yes, that's the plan.
Okay, great. That'll be great. Okay. So we'll do that in August, and then there's no closed session. Are there any member comments on items not on the agenda? Okay, so the next executive committee meeting is on July 17 at Hyperion's Los Angeles Environmental Learning Center, and then our next governing board meeting will be August 21st at 9:30 at the Delray Yacht Club again. So with that, thank you so much. So we can adjourn at 11:59. Thank you all.